Southerner Fraud True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. I always said I wouldn't cover this case. It's not because it's controversial or divisive. It's because it's difficult to be objective about Darlie Routier. I actually wasn't sure I could be objective, and despite my strong opinions, I do start every case with objectivity. Then I watched a couple of threads in our Facebook group, and I realized the tide is turning on this case. Regular folks have calmed down, whether they believe she is innocent or guilty. But others in the true crime community have now taken up Darlie's case as a sort of feminist cause. I find it really interesting that so many true crime podcasts declare her innocence, while so many regular people now believe she is guilty. And that began a spark for me. I really wanted to see the evidence. I knew how I felt, so as Haley began reading thousands of pages of trial transcripts, police reports, and appeals, I immersed myself in books, documentaries, and podcasts that were contrary to my own opinion of the case. I think that's a fair place to start. I will lay out the evidence for you to decide for yourself. I will share theories on both sides. And of course, I will give you my opinion. I will say this right from the jump. Darlie Routier is an enigma. But if you follow the evidence, the truth is in there. I just know it. Welcome to episode 139, Darlie Routier, part 1. In the early morning hours of June 6, 1996, a woman named Darlie Routier called 911, screaming that she and her sons had been stabbed. When police and paramedics arrived on the scene, 6-year-old Devin Routier, who would have been 7 in 1 week, was already dead from 2 deep stab wounds in his chest. 5-year-old Damon Routier had 4 stab wounds in his back and was unresponsive, but was still scooped up by a paramedic and put into an ambulance while life-saving measures were desperately tried. He had no pulse. He could not be revived. He was pronounced dead at Baylor Hospital in Dallas, Texas at 3:26 a.m., about an hour after his mother called 911. Darlie was brought to the hospital with what looked like a very serious slash to her throat and was taken immediately into surgery. The details of this case are voluminous, and as much as I would like to cut things down, I do believe that is part of the problem with many podcasts, documentaries, and articles on the case. If you're a pro-innocence, you are only going to give certain details. Pro-guilty people can also be short-sighted. They only need to give you enough information before you are ready to stick the needle in Darlie yourself. The brutal murder of small children will always be polarizing in cases like this. How could a mother do that to her sons? Or, a mother would never do that. See what I mean? It's that simple. So I am going to err on the side of too much information. I will do my best not to overwhelm you and keep it interesting. I had thought that I wanted to simply tell this story chronologically and wait for the trial to happen organically in the story. But that is almost impossible. So many things we know about this case came out in court. We need a lot of it for context, especially considering there are conflicting statements from the Routiers and first responders about what happened in that house that night. So I will start at the beginning as much as I can and try to walk you through chronologically while explaining things as I go. Darlie Lynn Peck was the 4th Darlie to be born into her family. She came right after New Year's on January 4th, 1970. That makes her 52 today. But in my head, she is sort of frozen at the age of 26. Her beautiful face contorted as she wept in her mugshot. Darlie Routier is a beautiful woman. Some think it's all flash, fake boobs, bleached blonde hair. But underneath the unfortunate styling of the time really is a classic beauty with prominent cheekbones, large hazel eyes, and a small mouth with straight white teeth. She was born in Altoona, Pennsylvania to parents Darlie and Larry. Larry was in Vietnam when Darlie was born, working as a military construction worker. The family moved back and forth to Lubbock, Texas, before finally settling there when Darlie was 13. Her parents divorced and her dad moved back to Pennsylvania, and Darlie's mom, Darlie Key, had two more daughters with another man and named her younger girls Danielle and Dana, continuing the D-name tradition. Darlie was 10 years older than Dana and 12 years older than Danielle. Because of their age differences, Darlie was more like a second mom to her sisters. Friends described Darlie as a sweet, thoughtful, and generous person. She loved to give gifts and help with charity. She volunteered at the school and helped with classroom parties. On Mother's Day in May 1985, when Darlie was 15 years old, her mom introduced her to a 17-year-old Darren Routier. He worked at a Western Sizzler steakhouse with her. The teen was actually Darlie Key's boss, the assistant manager. Darren has always been quite effusive about his first look at Darlie. Darren also hailed from a D-name family, and his brother Dion told D Magazine, I swear, no pun intended, that his brother was in awe of Darlie. Funny enough, everyone describes Darren Routier as this handsome guy, and as much as I will defend Darlie's natural beauty underneath all the bleach and Aquanet, I don't quite understand why everyone also describes Darren Routier as being handsome. It's not the unfortunate mullet. Obviously, I can get past the hairstyles. He's just kind of goofy looking. He is rather tall, though, and tall men often have an advantage of being considered handsome by default. I guess it's part of the tall, dark, and handsome thing. It could be charisma, though I've not seen that myself in interviews, but people are very different in person. Anyway, friends say he had a lot of girlfriends. He had been working since he was 14 and had his own car early in high school. He boasted in court that he started as a dishwasher at the Western Sizzler at 14, and by the time he went to college at 18, he was the manager. Darren also lettered in three sports. He played several positions on the football team, including linebacker and fullback. And in Texas, that's kind of a big deal. So I am guessing this is where talks of Darren's looks become part of the official story. I swear, I am not meaning to be superficial. There is a point to all of this. People often say that Darlie Routier didn't get a fair trial due to sexism, that the prosecution focused too much on her looks. They actually were trying to tie it back into her character, which I will get into more later. But my point is, the bombshell lore of Darlie Routier started way before she went on trial for murdering her children. This is a direct quote from Darlie's mother-in-law, Cyrilda, to D Magazine. Darlie has such a cute body that she ought to just walk around naked all the time. She was talking about teenaged Darlie, but I think you see my point. Darren Darlie and their whole families harped on Darlie's beauty. She was very hypersexualized, not just by others, but by herself as well. She has this sort of soft, breathy kind of high-pitched voice that completes the ditzy bombshell image. Her best friend said men stared at Darlie all the time and she was just used to it. She liked it. So did Darren. He was proud of his sexy wife. Her looks, and later the way she dressed and carried herself, were a huge part of who she was. It's just undeniable. So while some may think that is low-hanging fruit for the prosecution, I think it's understandable, especially the more you get to know the Routiers. And from all accounts, their first meeting at the Western Sizzler was kind of a romantic explosion. They were immediately inseparable, moving in together before Darlie was even an adult. Darren and Darlie married 3 years later, only waiting for Darlie to come of age. And yes, 15 and 17 is probably worrisome to a lot of you. In Texas, the age of consent is 17. However, they do have laws allowing teenagers within a 3-year age difference to have sex. These are called Romeo and Juliet provisions. Regardless, it's obvious Darlie's parents approved of the match. To be fair, her father still lived in Pennsylvania, and teenaged Darlie seemed to pretty much be on her own in Texas. When Darren turned 18, he and Darlie moved to Dallas, where he earned a degree from a tech school in electronics. While Darlie was still in high school, she and Darren went skiing in Colorado. While on the ski lift, Darren proposed and she accepted. On August 27, 1988, they married in a small ceremony in Darren's parents' home and then honeymooned in Jamaica. Their first son was born exactly 9 months later. Following their marriage, the newlyweds lived in an apartment in Garland. They both worked at Qplex, which was a circuit board manufacturing place. Darren started his own business called TestNack, testing circuit boards on the side while he was still working at Qplex. He ran the business out of their home. In June 1989, the couple moved to a home on Bond Street in Rowlett, Texas, which is a lakefront suburb around 30 minutes from Dallas. It's on Lake Hubbard and gets its name from Rowlett Creek, which flows into the lake and is a major tributary to the East Fork of Trinity River. Rowlett had a population of less than 45,000 around the time of the murders. It's not yet reached 70,000 today, but it's considered an upscale community, growing fast with nearly $1.5 billion in development and the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex located on the lake. The Lake Ray Hubbard Reservoir gives Rowlett more than 30 miles of shoreline. It was completed in 1971 and is owned by the City of Dallas and serves as one of their sources of drinking water. 2 days after the Routiers moved into their new home in Rowlett, Darley gave birth to their first child, Devin. Their second child, Damon, was also born there. Darren's side business continued to expand, and in 1992, he quit working at Qplex and they moved TestNack into an office building. In court, the state questioned how quickly Darren started his business, almost implying that he may have taken customers from his former bosses. But Darren rightly pointed out that he was taking a risk, walking away from a large company with insurance when he was starting a family. But he knew by then that he needed to make more money for the lifestyle he and Darley wanted. He was good friends with the owners of Qplex and said they supported his decision and were one of his customers. Darley worked the books at TestNack until she had her third son in October 1995. Then she would just go in every so often to check on things. Her best friend Barbara worked with them, and so did Darley's younger sister Dana. In 1993, Darren and Darley bought a corner lot house at 5801 Eagle Drive in Rowlett. You have to hand it to them. They were in their early 20s and owned a home. That's almost unheard of today. They weren't saddled with student debt, and they hit the ground running when they started their own business. They worked hard and began really enjoying the money. Darley's best friend, Barbara Jovell, said she felt like Darren and Darley had a good relationship for the most part, and they were faithful to each other. She said they took a lot of trips together and later with the kids. Barbara also testified that Darley was the dominant one in the relationship with Darren. In 1995, Darren grossed over $264,000. That's close to $500,000 in 2022 dollars. According to Barbara, Darley started to change when the business started doing well. She started shopping all the time. It seemed like all the money was going to Darley and none was going into the business. She wore designer clothes, fur coats, and lots of jewelry. And she decorated their home with over-the-top taste, including a large fountain in the front yard. D Magazine called the decor in the Routier home an eclectic mix of Terra and Graceland. But Darren also liked to spend money. He had an 86 Jaguar that he paid cash for, which he also bragged about in court. He collected expensive sports memorabilia, and he definitely enjoyed their flashy house and lifestyle as much as Darley did. He bought a cabin cruiser boat, which they took out on Lake Ray Hubbard all the time, until Darley had their third baby Drake in October 1995. Darren also wore a lot of chunky gold jewelry. So Darley's furs and jewelry were pretty well matched with her husband. The Routier home was kind of a party place with a hot tub out back, a bar set up, and wine rack in the kitchen. And in the family room, they had a state-of-the-art karaoke system set up. Supposedly, neighborhood kids called the Routier home the Nintendo house due to all the expensive toys. The Routier boys were also decked out in expensive clothing, their rooms immaculately decorated, and they did have just about any toy a kid could want. Devin Rush Routier was born on June 14, 1989. He was a jokester. He loved to make people laugh and play practical jokes. He liked to mimic funny things he saw or heard. Devin also loved jewelry like his parents did. He always wore a necklace and a watch. He loved to swim and was in the water from the time he was a baby. He loved video games, music, and singing. Family and friends say Devin was a really sweet-natured boy. He loved babies and was very gentle with them. Darley's friend Barbara said Devin was very smart and polite. He had just finished first grade before his murder. His younger brother, Damon Christian Routier, was born on February 19, 1991. He also loved to swim, just like Devin. Barbara described Damon as being very smart, but also a little bit on the moody side and kind of stubborn. She said Damon would ignore you if he didn't want to talk to you. He just sounds like a shy little boy to me. Devin and Damon were less than 2 years apart and were very close. Damon was 5 years old and had not even started kindergarten when he was murdered. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Barbara Jovell said her best friend Darlie was the kind of mom who would give the kids timeouts if they weren't behaving. She said sometimes she would swat their butts or squeeze their cheeks, but Barbara testified that the discipline always seemed to be proper. She did intimate that Darlie had to make Darren spend time with the boys. Darlie felt it was important that he be more involved, and Darren did as Darlie asked and started coming into work later so he could spend more time at home. But Darren also admitted in court that he was going through a lazy phase. He liked to sleep in and didn't get to work until noon unless he had packages to get out by 10 a.m. Darren's mother, Cyrilda, later testified that she and Darlie were very close. They spoke on the phone for an hour or two a week. Cyrilda said Darlie was the daughter-in-law that everyone would love to have. Darlie loved Darren and their children. Cyrilda said she was very close to Darren, and Darlie never got jealous about that, which I always think is a weird thing for mother-in-laws to say. But anyway, Darren's brother Dion later testified that Darlie was a very devoted mother. She did everything for those kids, he said. He never saw her do anything inappropriate with the kids. He said she always reasoned with them and never spanked them. Dion's wife Dana, yes, another D name to keep straight, testified that Darlie was the kind of mother she wanted to be. She said Darlie was, quote, very giving and very loving and very kind with her time. But not everyone was so complimentary of Darlie as a mother, or of Darren as a father for that matter. Eileen Skirmer and her family were neighbors with the Routiers. Eileen said there were concerns in the neighborhood about the safety of the Routier children. The Routiers lived on the corner, and they parked their cars on the corner. Neighbors were worried that if the boys were riding their bikes or playing behind the cars, that drivers wouldn't be able to see them dart out. Darren and Darlie didn't care when neighbors voiced their concerns. Another time, Eileen talked to the Routiers about how the boys were up on the other streets riding their bikes. She said they were way too young to be doing that unsupervised. Darlie wasn't concerned, and she did not tell her children to stay closer to the house. Eileen testified that in the summer of 1994, after the Routiers got the boat, they all went to the lake together. Even though the boys didn't know how to swim, the Routiers let them roam around the docks without life jackets. Eileen said that in June 1994, the Routiers had a birthday party for Devin. A water gun fight broke out, and Darlie told them to settle down. Devin was messing around and squirted Darlie a few times. Eileen said Darlie got really mad about it and immediately grabbed a piece of birthday cake off the table and shoved it right into his face. Kay Norris worked at a pawn shop that Darlie, Darren, and the kids would often come into. Darlie loved to buy jewelry at pawn shops. Kay testified that one day the whole Routier family came in. The shop had just gotten some exercise equipment in, and one of the boys started playing on it, and they were being loud. Darlie told Darren to go get them a few times, but he didn't. Darlie started yelling and cursing at them across the pawn shop. Kay said the first time she yelled, Darlie said, "Get your asses over here." When that didn't work, Darlie yelled, "Get the fuck over here." Allison Hennessy testified that she was friends with a girl named Renee. Renee lived in Darlie's neighborhood and also babysat for her. Renee babysat for the Routiers almost every weekend, and Allison would go hang out with Renee at the Routier's house. Darlie and Darren would often still be at the house while Renee and Allison were there. Allison testified that Darlie would let Devin and Damon play outside unsupervised when they were 3 and 5. Every time Renee, who was 16, babysat, Darlie would let her smoke cigarettes and drink Zimas. Once, Allison saw Darlie give Renee some weed. Darren claimed in court that they didn't like leaving the boys with sitters and that they did everything together as a family. Some of this stuff you might chalk up to the Routiers being inattentive parents. This stuff was used against Starley in court, but I think it's important that Darren get some of this heat too. He was equally inattentive and sounds lazy. However, the cursing and the birthday cake incident show Darley to have a hot temper and a mean temper. Smashing his own birthday cake in his face would have been so humiliating to 5-year-old Devin. The point of all this is, friends and family are going to show Darley as a good mother in court, while neighbors and other outsiders paint a different picture, and they have no reason to lie. The friends and family testifying were trying to save Darley's life. At the end of 1995, business started slowing down for Darren. It continued to slow down in 1996. By January, barely any money was coming in. In June, they were 2 months behind on their mortgage payments. They had $12,000 in credit card debt, and they were struggling to make even the minimum payments. They also owed $10,000 in back taxes, and Darren hadn't been able to pay rent for his office space for a couple of months. Barbara testified that in December 1995 and January 1996, the business was slow and money was not coming in. She said Darley came to the shop and checked the books, and then Darren would say she was really upset. When he gave Barbara her paycheck, he told her, quote, "Well, you're the only one getting paid now, because I'm not." When business started slowing down, Darley's demeanor changed again. According to Barbara, Darley became nervous and depressed, and she fought with Darren a lot. She would go into the shop and throw things at him. Then she said the arguments weren't physical, but they were frequent and usually over money. I would argue throwing things is a bit physical, but Barbara definitely tried to qualify a lot of her testimony. She said even with no money, Darley continued to shop and she hired people to help her take care of the house. But Barbara's point about this was that she was growing worried about Darley and tried to talk to Darren. She said, "Don't you see what's going on? Before the business stopped doing well, Darley was able to take care of the house, the children, and the business." She continued, "Don't you see lately, she has maids clean the house, she has people do the laundry, she has people to help with the children. There's something bothering Darley. Something is wrong." Barbara told Darren she thought Darley should see a doctor, but Darren seemed to blow off the suggestion. Even though they were having money problems, the Routiers were planning a 2-week trip to Pennsylvania in June to go to a family reunion, and Darley was supposed to go to Cancun in July with a friend. It sounds like they were in denial about their financial situation. Since they didn't have any cash for these trips and credit cards were maxed, on June 1st, 1996, Darren applied for a $5,000 loan, but was denied on the 3rd. $5,000 is not a significant amount in comparison to the kind of money Darren had been bringing in. This was less than 3 days before the murders. Darley later testified that they weren't short on money. She said money was tight, but all the bills were paid. She said they were 1 month behind on their mortgage, but it wasn't because they didn't have the money. It was because she forgot to pay the mortgage and other bills. She said she was used to paying the bills whenever she was at the shop, and when she started staying home full-time, it was an adjustment period. She said she just needed to get reorganized. But on May 8, 1996, 1 month before the murders, the Routiers received a letter from their mortgage company warning them that the situation was serious. By May 23rd, if they had not made the payments, they risked foreclosure. That deadline was exactly 2 weeks before the murders. Darren testified that they had around $64 in their personal bank account, but that was only because he hadn't paid himself yet. He was going to do so on Friday, June 7th. He had around $8,000 cash in the business account, and about $20,000 was owed to the company in accounts receivable. In court, he said he typically paid himself $1,000 to $1,500 a week, but for whatever reason, he had not paid himself. Darren said he made $111,000 in the first 5 months of 1996, and he was on track to make almost as much money as he had in 1995. The prosecution later said that when you took all the deposits for the first 5 months and then subtracted the checks paid up, that he was actually in the negative by nearly $3,000. But it wasn't just money problems. As Darley's friend Barbara had tried to point out, Something was going on with Darlie. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. When it comes to podcasts covering mystery and murder, Generation Y is a true original. If you're obsessed with crime and unsolved mysteries, this show has it all. Hosts Aaron and Justin cover cases from all angles. They break down theories, dive deep into forensic evidence, and discuss their opinions on the most perplexing cases. In a recent episode, Aaron and Justin look into the case of Lori DuPont. Lori was a well-respected 37-year-old nurse and single mom. She met a doctor named Mark Daniel at work, and they hit it off, beginning a secret relationship. But after a while, the romance cooled, and Mark began harassing Lori at work. Turns out, Mark had a history of dating and being abusive to nurses. Lori filed for a restraining order, but before a judge could issue it, Mark entered the hospital with a military sword and committed the unthinkable. I've listened to the Generation Y for years, starting when I was a commuter, and these guys were one of the first true crime podcasts on the scene. I enjoy their show so much and also respect their opinions. They come at cases with such fresh perspectives and impeccable research. Listen to the Generation Y podcast on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or you can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. I don't like New Year's resolutions, but I do like setting new goals. And on my list this year is learning a new language with Babbel, the new learning app that's sold more than 10 million subscriptions. Babbel teaches bite-sized language lessons for the real world. The 15-minute lessons make it a perfect way to learn a new language on the go. I studied French from high school to college, and I've always noticed I can pick up words in other romance languages. So I'm using Babbel to learn Spanish. The app is easy to navigate, and the lessons are fun and engaging. You can choose from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. There are so many ways to learn with Babbel. You can access podcasts, games, videos, stories, and live classes. Plus, it comes with a 20-day money-back guarantee. Right now, when you purchase a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's 6 months for the price of 3. Just go to Babbel.com and use promo code SFTC. That's Babbel.com, code SFTC. Babbel, language for life. The prosecution later theorized that even before Drake was born, Darlie was struggling with depression. They used her journal entries as evidence. She only had 6 entries in total. She said she started the journal so she could stop and breathe for a moment and reflect on what is important in her life. The first entry is melancholy. She is 7 months pregnant with Drake, and by her own admission, a little worried since it had been 5 years since she had her last baby. And she was reflecting on her grandmother, who she knew was lonely. It's almost like she was relating to her, though she doesn't say it outright. Just a week later, she wrote again, this time worrying about her mother and sister. Mostly about her mother, who was in counseling. And she said some strange things about her mom's third husband, Denny. Quote, I don't understand why Denny did to me what he did, so it is very hard to try and forgive him. I know he must have a dark secret that happened as a child. And I pray to the Lord that one day he will ask for true forgiveness for his own soul. Eternity is a long time. That last line is really ironic, considering what she would soon be accused of herself. But then the rest of the entry is about the boys. Damon had spent a week with his grandmother, and she had missed him. Quote, I really have enjoyed the time with Devin, but when one of my babies are away, I do not feel complete. I guess that's because they are such a part of my life. Then, sometimes I pray the Lord will guide them down the right path so that they will have a prosperous life. They deserve health, happiness, and peace. We all deserve that. Maybe if we could all relax a little more, then the world would be a much better place. I will close for now, and I ask the Lord to watch over all of us and help us to make the right decisions. I am going to admit some of my own original bias in this case. You know how they say every con finds religion. Or the joke, there are no atheists on death row. Darlie, as most of you know, is on death row, and she talks about God all the time in every interview over the years. The cynical side of me noted that she and Darren had not been regular churchgoers. In fact, there was a reverend who became very close to Darlie during her time in jail. He officiated at her son's funerals. But that was when he first met the Routiers. Darren's brother had been a member of his congregation. Darley seemed to have charmed him. He visited her some 50 times and testified in her favor. Though the prosecution pointed out, as I have noted, that the Routiers were not regular churchgoers or particularly religious. But in fairness, these journal entries seem to be devotional, almost missives to God. I think Darley may have been more spiritual than she was given credit for. But that does not mean she was incapable of murdering her children. And she did seem to be in a depression. In the month that Drake was born, she wrote, "Everything hurts, and I can't seem to get over it. It's not fair to Darren or the boys, but nothing I do makes me feel better. I really love Darren with all my heart, but sometimes I feel like I'm missing something. I don't know what it could be. I'm sure I have everything every woman could ever wish for." She went on to write, quote, "Maybe it's the excitement, things I used to do when I was younger, the thrill of not knowing, just doing whatever came up. I know I have a lot of responsibilities, but a little craziness once in a while wouldn't hurt. I want to grow old with Darren, but I don't want to feel as though a part of me has to die to do it. I am young, and I want to feel it. Time goes too quickly not to enjoy each moment." Darley later defended this entry, saying she was just reminiscing, but it does sound like a woman unhappy with her life, with her responsibilities. And to be fair, she married at 18 and had her first baby at 19. Maybe that was catching up with her. And again, I am going to play devil's advocate. This was her journal. We often write things in our journal that we would not say aloud. Sometimes, as Darley herself noted, we write in journals or diaries as a way of expressing ourselves, just, you know, getting it out of your system. I have journaled a lot over the years, and I tend to wince when I reread these things. I am often surprised at how unhappy I sounded at the time, but that's often what people use journals for, a kind of personal therapy. Darley did not journal regularly, so this does seem like some self-therapy. But these were the 2 months before the murders. In March of 1996, Darley had stopped breastfeeding Drake and started taking diet pills Fastfin and Pondamin. These drugs were more commonly known as Fen-Phen. They were taken off the market for many bad side effects, including what is called Fenrage. On Phenermine.com, among regular side effects are fairly extreme warnings about the Fenrage problem, quote, "With more than 1 in 5 patients reporting dysphoria at some point during treatment, Phentermine anger issues are one of this medication's most commonly reported side effects. This seemingly uncontrollable, sometimes irrational anger and frustration is colloquially referred to as Fenrage." Darley was said to have had around 12 to 15 pounds to lose after having Drake. By May, she had lost almost all of it. Darley testified about the pills, quote, "They did not make me feel irritable or jumpy. The only thing I felt from them is like a dryness in my mouth. So you tended to drink a lot more water. But that's about it. I mean, I still ate." She said the pills did not alter her emotions or have any effect that she was aware of. But multiple people testified that Darley was very bothered by her weight gain. The prosecution asked Darren if Darley had a lot of trouble losing weight, and Darren said, "Not a lot of trouble." The prosecution said Darren told a woman named Jamie Johnson that Darley was a size 4 before Drake and went to a size 8. Darren said, "No, she went to a size 6. But good Lord, most women would love to be a size 8, so why was he quibbling? Because he took great pride in Darley's figure. The prosecution said Darren told Jamie that Darley went into a postpartum depression, somewhat aggravated by her weight. Jamie Johnson was from Child Protective Services. She was evaluating the Routiers' ability to care for Drake after the murders. Darren testified that Darley liked to look nice and that she was, quote, a very beautiful girl. The prosecution got him to admit that Darley's appearance is very, very important to Darley and to him. In 1992, they paid $5,000 for her to get breast implants since she had just had 2 children. On April 21st, 1996, Darley wrote a long journal entry, starting with baby Drake, and then talking about the rest of her family, including her sisters. She said a lot about wanting to be a good example and remembered for being a good person. She hinted at trouble with her marriage, quote, "I pray for God to put his hand down upon my marriage. We need to be strong and help guide each other back to the right path." She went on, quote, "Devin and Damon are growing too fast and become more aware of the world every day. And unfortunately, children tend to be persuaded towards the negative instead of being hopeful for the positive. We all have to show our children the difference between right and wrong choices and make them understand that there are reactions and consequences for every choice we make in life. Maybe she is just ruminating or praying, but it does seem sort of pointed. Darlie testified that she was wondering how she fit into the world when she wrote this entry. On the 29th, she wrote about how they had gone to a wedding, and it made her realize how important marriage was. She said she and Darren planned to renew their vows on their 10th anniversary. I think all of these journal entries can be interpreted differently. I've been giving you my impressions, of course, but you can see them however you want. But on May 3rd, 1 month before the murders, she wrote what the state called a suicide letter. Quote, "Dear Devin, Damon, and Drake, I hope that one day you will forgive me for what I am about to do. My life has been such a hard fight for a long time, and I just cannot find the strength to keep fighting anymore. I love you three more than anything else in this world. I don't want you to see a miserable person every time you look at me. Your dad loves all of you very much, and I know in my heart he will take care of my babies. Please do not hate me or think in any way that this is your fault. It's just that I..." And then the letter is cut off. On the stand, she minimized the entry, saying she had just been moody. She said she had been crying a lot and she wasn't, quote, a big crier. She said as she wrote the letter, she began to feel silly and embarrassed, but she admitted in court that she did call Darren at work that day and insisted he come home. She was crying, told him that she had been crying a lot and didn't understand why she was feeling that way. She told him about the journal and she said they cried together. Then she admitted she had thought about taking some sleeping pills. She didn't say the word overdose or the word suicide. She just said that she had been, quote, thinking of taking some pills when she had been crying and thinking. She said that when Darren went to work the next day, it was because she told him she was feeling a lot better, and he told her to call him if she had any problems. She promised she would and said, quote, "And I think I was still a little bit moody, a little bit cryy for the next couple of days, but soon after that, I got my first menstrual cycle that I had not had in over a year." She said she had the over-the-counter sleeping pills in her nightstand drawer, but had never taken them out, and that Darren had later flushed them down the toilet. She definitely was minimizing the whole incident. Her best friend Barbara testified that it was more serious. She said Darren told her about this suicide attempt, and she went to visit Darlie. Darlie told her that when Darren came in, she was writing the note and then she hid it under the bed. She had taken the pills out of their wrappers and did plan to take them. Darren only found out because their dog Domino had dragged the wrappers out from under the bed and he confronted her. Barbara testified that Darlie told her she wanted to take her own life because, quote, "sometimes she gets to feel really strange and she doesn't understand why. Pretty much that things were happening and she felt strange and she just didn't understand why." Barbara went on about what Darlie said to her, quote, "things were getting to her. Sometimes she feels like everybody expected too much of her, and the children were sometimes too much. And she just feels that she wants to end it all." Darlie was nervous and depressed, and she fought with Darren a lot. Barbara said she told Darlie that she should get some help. She should go to counseling and possibly get on some medication. Darlie said she might go. She could take the kids to stay with Darren's mom while she sought treatment. But then, Darlie said she was worried Darren's mom might try to take the children away. This seems counter to the glowing relationship her mother-in-law, Cyrilda, had testified to. Darren also minimized the incident, insisting that Darlie had only had the baby blues for a couple of days. He wasn't concerned about it. He said he never read the note Darlie had written because it was in her private journal. He said when he found her crying in bed writing in her journal, that she told him he needed to spend more time with the kids, and he knew she had sleeping pills, but did not think she was serious about taking her own life. If he had thought she was serious, he would have gotten her help. He backed up Darlie's story, quote, "we had a good long hard cry," and then he said he went back to work. The next day was, quote, "a whole new day and everything was fine." In the next 2 days, she had her first menstrual cycle in over a year, and she was back to being herself. A psychiatrist named Dr. Lisa Clayton, who interviewed Darlie 2 days after the murders, later testified that this was not a genuine suicide attempt, but, quote, "a gesture." Quote, "she was at her wit's end about being overwhelmed with the house and kids, but not only did she and Darren work it out, but Darlie did get her period, and there was a dramatic change in her mood, and this was not some chronic depression or postpartum psychosis that lasted until the events in the first part of June, as she called the murders. Dr. Clayton continued, From my evaluation of Mrs. Routier, it is my opinion that she had suicidal ideation. I think it was more a cry for attention and help from her husband. And I want to note for the record that while Dr. Clayton began as Darlie's jail psychiatrist, she was hired by the defense for expert testimony. And Darlie's defense team would want her depression to be minimized as much as possible. I'm going to pause now to hear a final word from today's sponsors. Today's episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. What interferes with your happiness? Or is something preventing you from achieving your goals? BetterHelp is there for you. They were there for me when I was suffering from post-surgery depression. They have licensed professionals in all 50 states who specialize in all kinds of issues like depression, anxiety, trauma, grief, and family conflicts. Connect in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient. You can start communicating in under 48 hours. BetterHelp is also available for clients worldwide. Find the particular expertise you need online. Don't limit yourself to the counselors located near you. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is professional counseling done securely online. You can message your counselor anytime and you'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions. BetterHelp is convenient, confidential, and more affordable than traditional offline counseling. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor, BetterHelp.com/Southern. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Again, that's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Southern. Southern Fried listeners know I play Best Fiends all the time, year-round. But it's also really fun to play during the hectic holidays when I need a little pick-me-up. Best Fiends has it all, an amazing storyline, collectible fiends, and tons of fun puzzles. It's way more fun than other Match 3 style puzzle games. I swear, 30 minutes go by like 30 seconds. And no Wi-Fi? No problem. Play Best Fiends wherever and whenever you want with offline mode. I woke up this morning and my power was out. It came back quickly, but my Wi-Fi took forever to reset afterwards, so I played Best Fiends while I waited. So even if your holiday travels take you off the beaten path, you can still play Best Fiends. I've been playing for almost 2 years, ever since Best Fiends became one of my most supportive sponsors. I've made it to level 2342, but I've still got literally thousands of levels to play, with more added all the time. Best Fiends is an action-packed adventure and a brain-boosting puzzle game all rolled into one. And with new content added all the time, you're never bored. Download Best Fiends free today on the App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. On June 5th, 1996, Darlie's best friend Barbara arrived at the Routier house at 5:15 p.m. to pick up her mother Helena, who cleaned the Routier home. She testified that Darlie was upset, pacing back and forth between the kitchen and family room. Barbara saw that Darlie was holding something while pacing, but she didn't know what it was. Things were so uncomfortable in the house that Barbara and her mom left within 30 minutes. Darlie and Darren both later testified that they had not had any disagreements or arguments later that night. Darlie testified, quote, "There wasn't an argument. That's all been taken out of context. There was not an argument about the boat. There was not an argument about the car. What I was upset about was that a man had called me earlier, and he was very rude and had cussed me out over the phone. My husband's car was at his shop, and he wanted my husband to come pick it up, and he was very rude to me, and I was upset." Dr. Clayton backed this up in court. Quote, "People kind of describe Darren, or the people that I've interviewed, as someone you kind of have to tell him several times to do something before he does it. So she was kind of aggravated. She stated because he hadn't done it." Are you guys hearing the running theme of Darren's laziness? I mean, he gets a couple of points for admitting it in open court, but damn. You kind of wish at some point that he had really stepped up. He just seems blind to it all. Anyway, she also said Darlie mentioned the neighborhood kids were running in and out of the house during all this, adding to the chaos. Dr. Clayton also added that Darren was taking Darlie's Pathfinder since the Jaguar was out of commission, leaving her and the boys stranded now that school was out. She said Darlie was really upset about that. Darlie had also complained about their cabin cruiser boat to the psychiatrist. It was also broken down and was going to cost a lot of money, and they didn't use it anyway since they had baby Drake. Darren would later say the boat repairs would have been north of $3,000. Dr. Clayton said Darlie was upset about the Jaguar and the boat because they were both, quote, kind of Darren's deal, and she wanted him to make a decision to get things done. She said Darley did say they argued back and forth, with the end result being that Darren would fix the boat and sell it, and then fix the car, and then find a more reliable means of transportation. Well, that all sounds like a simple enough argument that wouldn't be that big of a deal until you remember the house was about to go into foreclosure. You would think that would have been the main discussion. And maybe it was. Maybe Darley brought up the smaller, nagging factors of what she might have been angry about that night. Maybe everything was snowballing for her. Darren also minimized the mortgage situation, saying he just needed to pay himself. But unless these people were just ignoring their mail, they knew they were in trouble, and if he had the cash, why not go ahead and pay himself so he could pay the mortgage? This is a big part I do not understand. If you could pay yourself, why risk foreclosure? In court, it also came out that one of his big machines was down at work and would be expensive to fix. Maybe that was why he waited. But he didn't say that. He didn't explain any of it. But whatever argument the Routiers had was not the most alarming thing to have happened that day. Helena, Barbara's mother, was there to clean and do laundry. There was a younger woman named Rebecca who was supposed to be Drake's nanny. Helena testified at a hearing, not in front of the jury, that when she got to the house on June 5th, she asked where the baby was, and Rebecca pointed her finger towards Darley's lap. Helena looked, and it appeared Darley was holding a bundled up blanket. Helena told Darley to give her the baby, and Darley didn't move. Helena repeated herself, and Darley said that Drake liked to be held that way. Helena said, "Please give me the baby." And Darley handed the baby over and then went upstairs. Helena very slowly uncovered Drake. The blanket had been covering his face. Once Helena got the blanket off of his face, she noticed that his face was, quote, very perspired, very red, and the lips were light blue. Drake started to catch his breath and then started crying. Helena said she comforted Drake until he calmed down. Throughout the rest of the day, Helena saved Drake from being harmed multiple times. One time, he almost hit the glass coffee table and she caught him. Darley and Rebecca just laughed. Another time, Drake almost fell out of his high chair and Helena caught him. And the judge ruled this whole story prejudicial and not similar enough to the murders to be admissible. For those who say she didn't get a fair trial, I hope you're paying attention. This was an upsetting incident, an incident where Darley could have been harming one of her children on the very day before the murders, but the judge kept it out. This is one point I am making. I will get to more about whether or not Darley got a fair trial later on. Anyway, Helena did laundry, dusted, and vacuumed. She put the vacuum by the kitchen and left it in between the wine rack and the pantry. That will be important later. Then, Darley showed Helena some jewelry she had and said she needed $10,000. After looking at the jewelry, they left it on the kitchen counter. Why Darley thought the woman who cleaned her home could afford to hand over $10,000 in cash for jewelry is beyond me. But it reeks of desperation. Darren also testified that after he got home from work and they had dinner, he and Darley were organizing the garage so that they could have a garage sale. These people were collectors. They loved buying things. But Darren said they were organizing stuff that very night for a garage sale. Barbara came and picked Helena up, and as they left, they saw a black sports car. It stopped, and a second person got in. It sped off, which scared Helena. She would be allowed to testify to this part of the day. On June 6th, at 2:30 a.m., 26-year-old Darley called 911. Quote, "Operator, 911, what's your emergency?" Darley screams, "Somebody came here. They broke in." The operator interjects, "Ma'am?" Darley screams, "They just stabbed me and my children." The operator says, "What?" Darley screams, "They just stabbed me and my kids, my little boys." At 9.5 seconds in, the operator asks, "Who? Who did?" Darley just screams, "My little boy is dying." The operator says, "Hang on," and by the 23-second mark, she dispatches unknown medical emergency to 5801 Eagle Drive. 27 seconds in, the operator says, "Ma'am, I'm trying to get an ambulance to you. Hang on a minute." The operator keeps saying, "Ma'am," trying to reassure her that help is on the way and get more information. 29 seconds in, Darley says, "Oh my God, my babies are dying." The operator asks, "What's going on, ma'am?" Within 40 seconds, Darren Routier has come into the room but is unintelligible. You can't understand him until the 1 minute, 12 seconds in when he says, "Oh my God," right after Darley distinctly says, "I saw them, Darren." By 51 seconds, the operator is relating to dispatch that it's a possible stabbing. Darley keeps screaming. A lot of it is unintelligible. She says, "Oh my God," many times. And, "Oh my God, my baby's dead." At 1:08, the operator notes to the dispatcher, quote, "hysterical female on the phone." And at 1:14, the operator tells Darley she needs her to calm down and talk to her. And Darley says, "Didn't you get my address?" The operator repeats the address back, and Darley said, "Yes, we need help." At 1:24, Darley can be heard saying, "Darren, I don't know who it was." And then, "We got to find out who it was." The operator keeps saying, "Ma'am, I need you to talk to me." At 1:44, Darley wails, "My babies are dead." The operator says, "Slow down and talk to me." And at 2:02, Darley says, quote, "Some man came in, stabbed my babies, stabbed me. I woke up. I was fighting. He ran out through the garage, threw the knife down. My babies are dying. They're dead. Oh my God." The operator can hear Darley talking to Darren and said, "Ma'am, who's there with you?" At 2:38, the operator asks, "Is anybody in the house besides you and your children?" Darley answers, "No. My husband, he just ran downstairs. He's helping me, but they're dying. Oh my God, they're dead." At 2:53, Darley says, "I feel really bad. I think I'm dying." You can still hear the operator relaying things to dispatch, clarifying it is two kids and giving the address again. At 3:00, Darley asks, "When are they going to be here?" She repeats it twice, and the operator assures her they're on the way. At 3:12, Darley can be heard saying, "Who would do this? Who would do this?" At 3:45, you can hear the first officer on the scene say, "Look for a rag." Darley answers, "They killed our babies." Then she says, "Y'all look out in the garage. Look out in the garage. They left a knife laying on." And the operator interjects, "There's a knife? Don't touch anything." Darley says, "I already touched it and picked it up." By 4:00, there's another officer at the door, and the operator tells Darley to let him in. 5:00, the operator has to say it again. You can hear Darley talking to the officer. At 5:04, she says, quote, "His knife was lying over there, and I already picked it up." The operator says, "Okay, it's all right, it's okay." Darley says, "God, I bet if we could have gotten the prints, maybe, maybe." At 5:19, Darley says, quote, "Somebody who did it intentionally walked in here and did it, Darren." She also says repeatedly, "There's nothing touched." Finally, at 5:33 into the call, the operator asks, "Ma'am, is the police officer there?" Darley says yes, and the operator says, "Okay, go talk to him." And the call finally ends. I did not play you the actual 911 recording for a few reasons. First of all, I noticed from a thread in our Facebook group that most people do not like listening to them for various reasons that I completely agree with. I think they can be jarring to hear within a narrative format like this show, especially one like Darley Routier's, where there is a lot of screaming and distortion. Also, most of you have probably heard this tape ad nauseum. The Darley Routier case is an extremely famous American case, almost up there with O.J. Simpson, but at the very least up there with Jeffrey McDonald. In fact, there are many eerie parallels with the McDonald case. So you've probably heard this call, but if not, I will have a link to the 911 call in today's show notes. Lastly, you will notice in the link I provide that there are two files, the original recording and the state's enhanced copy of the recording. Defense attorneys disputed things that were or were not in the transcripts because of the two recordings. Basically, they say you can hear many things in the background on the original recording. I can get into that more later, but I've listened several times to both recordings and I don't hear it. But they also dispute parts of the transcript. They disagree with how the state interpreted the recording. So that is my main reason for not playing it. The quotes I gave you from the 911 call are not in dispute by Darley's defense or by the state. This is the most fair way to handle the 911 call anyway, since there is a dispute with Darley's defense and there's no need to aggravate your ears. But I will point out now that you can tell from the quotes I've given you that Darlie stays on the phone for a while. The call is 5 minutes 38 seconds long, and the operator has to tell Darlie to go talk to the police officer. Most hysterical people will hang up very quickly and go back to their child. The operator, asking someone to stay on the phone, is usually trying to give CPR instructions. But the operator can't even get this far with Darlie Routier, though she did stay on the line. And Darlie's words, already seeming to explain her fingerprints, will come back to haunt her. In court, Darren Routier will testify and say something strange about the moments in that 911 call. He said, "I looked up at Darlie, and I didn't even see the cuts on her neck. And I looked at her, and it was just this look, this contact we had. Just this immediate contact. She didn't have to ask me nothing, and I didn't have to ask her nothing." Whatever happened that night, Darren and Darlie didn't need to question each other. Southern Fried True Crime is written, hosted, and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched by the one and only Haley Gray, with additional research by me. You only have to wait a few days for the second part in my series on Darlie Routier, as I will head out to Marietta, Georgia on Friday to host the very first True Crime Film Festival. Check out my social media for more information. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Coley Horner. Please submit case suggestions to southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept suggestions on social media, and I apologize if I am unable to answer your email. I get dozens of suggestions a week, and it takes time to go through and check out each case. Thank you all so much for sending in these suggestions. I truly get my most interesting cases from listener suggestions, so keep them coming. Don't forget to come find our Facebook group. Search for Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discussion Group. We still worship our patron saint, Dolly Parton, share fun memes and delicious recipes. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say, "No shit ass is allowed." It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, and Spotify. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.